Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Earlier this week, we released an episode titled Sympathy for the Devil, Altamont. The episode detailed the events that occurred in the lead-up and during the now infamous Altamont Free Concert in 1969. The concert, they said, that ultimately led to the end of the 60s peace and love movement. Consider tonight's mini-episode a sequel to that episode of sorts. A small little add-on article that fits snugly at the side of the first part. As always, my best advice is to listen to the first part in this sequence of episodes in order to get the full value and experience from tonight's follow-up. So if you haven't checked it out already, head over and listen to Sympathy for the Devil, then enjoy this part straight after. In July of 1979, following an unusually stormy summer's day, a group of Hell's Angels quietly gathered within the dark recesses of the night. These particular Hell's Angels were killers, men contracted to carry out one single task. The bikers in question had been stalking their target for a number of months, and tonight was the night they intended to take action. The person in their line of sight, so to speak, was the Rolling Stones frontman Mick Jagger. The British rock star known the world over for his moves, his voice, his attitude, his music. But to the Hell's Angels, he was known for something more. The contract killers, themselves active in the infamous biker gang, had been shadowing Jagger for over a week. They had first tracked down the famed rocker while he was staying at the home of New York pop artist Andy Warhol. The Angels had performed reconnaissance outside Warhol's luxurious and sprawling estate in the Hamptons. They had discovered that it was patrolled by armed guards round the clock, so they were reluctant to launch a frontal assault against a position that was heavily guarded by armed security. The Angels surveilled the guards for several days and observed their automatic rifles, but also learned their shift pattern and movements. The Angels called off the operation, though, and decided to bide their time and wait for a more dead-certain opportunity. It was unusual for Jagger to be staying at the home of Andy Warhol. Warhol wasn't home, and Jagger had his own home in the Hamptons less than a mile away. While tracking Jagger and scouting out his location, the Angels had came up with what they thought would be a much better idea. Genius, in fact. Instead of blasting their way into the mansion via the front door, which it has to be said was their original plan, they would instead take a much more clandestine approach to the situation. Their revised plan was to completely bypass security by obtaining a small boat and sailing across the Long Island Sound and into the backyard of Jagger's Hampton estate. The house backed out openly onto the water. The Hell's Angels hitmen would then quietly plant explosives beneath Jagger's home before sailing back and detonating the explosives once they were far enough away to get away scot-free. But let's backtrack slightly and quickly recap as to why the Hell's Angels were so intent on murdering one of the most famous musicians of all time. As I covered in the previous episode, on December 6, 1969, a massive free concert was set to take place at the Altamont Speedway racetrack, around an hour away from San Francisco near Livermore in California. The concert had been conceived as a celebration of the 60s peace and free love ideals, but because of horrendously poor planning, the event turned into an absolute disaster. A disaster that would include the deaths of 4 fans who attended the concert. Further, history would not be kind in remembering the event, and rightly so, with the Rolling Stones themselves also being tarred with the brush of blame. It is perhaps one of the most controversial moments in music history and is often cited as being a bookmark to the end of the hippie period. In November of 69, the Rolling Stones were perhaps one of the biggest and most popular bands in the world, perhaps the biggest, with the exception of the Beatles, of course. the Stones were embarking on their first United States tour in over 3 years, following them being hidden away recording their latest album for an extended period. The tour was hugely successful, although the band faced a lot of criticism in the media and from fans due to the high ticket prices for the shows. Jerry Hopkins, writing for Rolling Stone magazine in November 1969, stated, quote,
"It begins with two evening shows at the Forum in Los Angeles, November 8th, with tickets priced from $5.50 to $8.50. This compares to a $7.50 top price for a Blind Faith concert in the same arena, a $6.50 for the Doors, and in both those concerts, tickets started at $3.50. Promoters of the Los Angeles concert said the gross for the evening would exceed $275,000 if the Stones filled the 18,000 seats in the Forum for both shows. I don't know how much people can afford. I've no idea. Is that a lot? You'll have to tell me."
Further, another critic, the noted and respected Ralph Gleason, who wrote at the time for the San Francisco Chronicle, stated thus, quote,
"Do the Rolling Stones actually need all that money? If they really dig the black musicians as much as every note they play and every syllable they utter indicates, is it possible to take out a show with, say, Ike and Tina and some of the older men like Howlin' Wolf and let them share in the loot? How much can the Stones take back to Merry England after taxes anyway? How much must the British manager and the American manager and the agency rake off the top? It says a very bad thing to me about the artist's attitude towards the public. It says they despise their own audience."
Incidentally, when the Stones played the New York show on this tour, they did in actual fact take Ike and Tina out on the show with them. In response to the comments in the media, the Stones decided to prove those critics wrong by ending their tour with a huge open-air free concert in California and include other popular acts at the time such as Jefferson Airplane, Santana, and the Grateful Dead. The concert organizers had been inspired by the Woodstock Music Festival, which had taken place 4 months earlier in New York State. In fact, Michael Long, the organizer of Woodstock 69, 94, and the now infamous 99, was at the Altamont show. He claims he had no involvement in the organization of the event. Woodstock, as I'm sure you know, turned into a worldwide phenomenon. It was a centerpiece of the hippie generation and quickly became a seminal moment in music history. Its reputation was aided by the documentary movie that they shot at the festival, showing many of the positive aspects of the weekend and also the iconic bands and musicians that performed during its 4-day runtime. What's not discussed about the original Woodstock is that there were 3 fatalities at the event, not the commonly whispered about 2. Of those deaths, 2 were fatal drug overdoses out of more than 700 drug overdoses that occurred that weekend in total, and another death which was caused when a tractor ran over a 17-year-old boy who was asleep in his sleeping bag at the time, in a hayfield. Additionally, there was insufficient food, water, and sanitation. The National Guard were put on standby due to unruly drug and alcohol-fueled crowds, though the National Guard was cancelled at the very last minute by the mayor. A state of emergency was declared in Sullivan County, where Woodstock Festival was held, though. And finally, there were 4 rapes reported over the weekend, which seems low given how many people were there, but given the time period where sexual assault was rarely reported and a culture where free love ran wild, we can assume that the true figure is much higher. More than 6,000 medical issues were also reported over the 4-day event. So Woodstock had some damn good PR, and the editing of that movie played an integral role in perpetuating the false peace, love, and freedom image that is synonymous with Woodstock today. Fun fact, part of the mythology of Woodstock was that it was this huge gathering of like-minded people who would share in the peace and love mentality while enjoying the biggest musical artists of the day. And all for free, because money is evil, apparently. In actual fact, Michael Long and his co-organizers did ticket and charge for the event, but people just pulled down the security fences and walked in for free. But it was never the intention. Long actually aimed to make a sizable profit from the event originally. He also arranged food vendors to sell food to the concertgoers at huge markups. But again, the concert-goers refused to pay the extortionate prices and just stole what they wanted to eat. Peace and love. Anyway, the Stones wanted to emulate their perception of Woodstock on the East Coast. It was also hoped that the California concert would achieve a similar level of success and also gain a similar cultural reputation. Sure, the tickets would be free, but the Stones were also shrewd businessmen and had a financial interest in the concert being as large as possible. As their US tour was being filmed for a documentary, the band had negotiated a deal where they would receive 50% of the film's profits. They hoped it would turn a profit as large as the Woodstock movie. It was eventually released, and titled Gimme Shelter, by the way, if you wish to seek it out. So the show was scheduled for December 6th, as I stated. The planning was plagued by issues from the start. No one involved had ever promoted a concert on this scale and at such short notice. Hell, at that time there had only been a small handful of concerts this size, and mainly in England. Festivals were an entirely new thing in the United States. What turned out to be the Altamont Free Concert was originally set to take place on the grounds of San Jose State University. But a previous concert, held a couple of weeks beforehand, had drawn a crowd of over 80,000 people, and they had left a trail of destruction in their wake. This led city officials to revoke the Stones' permit application, as the city had no desire for a repeat of the incident. The next location that was touted was Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. Again, though, they were denied due to the city's mayor having a deep dislike of hippies and the counterculture movement. Ironic, given the city he governed. With the concert organizers starting to become desperate with the date of the already advertised concert looming, they managed to secure the Sears Point Raceway. Work hastily began on building the facilities and laying the infrastructure that would be needed for an event that was expected to draw around 100,000 spectators in total. The owners of the Sears Point Raceway, however, also owned another concert venue in California, and several months prior, the Rolling Stones had cancelled a performance there at the very last minute. Once they saw the very precarious situation the concert organizers were in, the Sears Raceway owners seized the opportunity to demand $100,000 in cash up front, and they also wanted the sole distribution rights to the tour documentary, which the Stones were currently filming. The Sears team thought they had the upper hand and had backed the Stones into a corner. The Rolling Stones and their team wouldn't have enough time to rearrange for a fourth time with only days until the show, they thought. The Stones rejected this demand, though, and balked at the request. They would rather amble through than bow to such shitty demands. So the venue would be changed again on Thursday, December 4th, just 2 days before the concert was to take place. Altamont Speedway was the final choice. It was quite literally in the middle of nowhere. This meant that the organizers weren't able to ensure that the concert had proper restrooms, medical facilities, parking, or most importantly, security. So they had to cut some corners in order to make it work. This is where the Hell's Angels come into the picture. The Hell's Angels were hired to police the event, although the Hell's Angels' own understanding of what they were required to do differed from that of Jagger and the other organizers. Later interviews with both the Rolling Stones and members of the Hell's Angels would quickly establish a huge void in their understanding. The most commonly accepted story is that the Angels were hired based off the recommendations of Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead, who had both previously used the Angels for security at their concerts and seemingly without incident. From Jagger's perspective, he was only too happy to have the Angels provide security. Firstly, he hated police with a passion, as he witnessed at almost every single one of their concerts at the time, the sheer brutality and unnecessary violence from the police toward his fans. But secondly, Jagger had hired the Hell's Angels to provide security at their London Hyde Park concert several months before, and that worked out perfectly. There was only one snag, however. The British Hell's Angels were a very different organization to their American counterpart. For the most part, the British Hell's Angels were a club for motorbike enthusiasts. They weren't criminals, and they fitted into society just fine. Most had regular day jobs, families, and just liked meeting with like-minded individuals to ride their bikes together. The American Hells Angels, however, were a notoriously violent criminal organization who ran guns, dealt drugs, organized prostitution rackets, and provided hitmen for hire. Whether Mick Jagger realized this or not at the time is unclear. But the management for the Stones and the Grateful Dead met with members of the San Francisco chapter of the Hells Angels and pushed ahead with their plan. A deal was made for the Angels to provide security at the concert. That much is agreed upon by both sides. The specifics, however, are debated. The only part of the deal that everyone agrees to be true is that the Angels were hired to attend the concert in exchange for $500 worth of beer. That's the equivalent of over $4,500 of beer by 2024 value. 100,000 people would attend the event, so that was doable, the Angels thought. Although on the day of the concert, well over 300,000 rowdy, drunk, drug-fueled fans poured into the Speedway. There was no food or water for the 300,000 spectators either, and worse, no restroom facilities. Drugs were openly shared amongst the concertgoers from the onset. PCP, LSD, and speed were openly being passed around for all to share and indulge in. Alcohol was also not in short supply. The fans weren't the only ones getting drunk and high, though. The Hells Angels had also eagerly started swilling down their $500 worth of beer, and by the time the concert started, many of the Angels were hammered. Anyway, to cut to the chase, the Hells Angels got more and more out of control, violent and abusive toward the fans and the bands who were performing. The situation soon completely spiraled out of control, with numerous fights breaking out between members of the audience and the Angels. Due to the violence which was occurring in the crowd, and also the assault on the singer of Jefferson Airplane while they were performing, the Grateful Dead, who were set to perform prior to the Rolling Stones, made the decision to leave the event immediately. Whilst this was smart in that they protected themselves in doing so, they would not realize how that decision would only increase tensions. With the Grateful Dead leaving, it left an almost 2-hour gap in the concert's schedule, where the stage was completely empty. This, of course, only angered and unsettled the already agitated crowd and volatile Hells Angels further. By the time the Rolling Stones arrived, the concert had devolved into complete chaos. Mick Jagger was assaulted the moment he arrived and stepped out of his helicopter. But nevertheless, the show must go on, and the band made their way to the stage. As the Stones performed, fights erupted in the crowd. Perhaps I shouldn't call them fights. The Hells Angels brutally assaulted multiple concertgoers in vicious and volatile displays of brutality. An 18-year-old named Meredith Hunter was fatally stabbed to death by a member of the Hells Angels named Alan Pizarro. Since the concert was being filmed for a documentary, the entire incident was captured on camera. Meredith, it turned out, had taken a gun to the concert for protection. Meredith was a black teenager, and he was concerned that racial issues may occur at the concert, and he wanted to ensure that he was safe. Peace and love. Meredith had a .22 caliber revolver on his person, and he had pushed his way to the front near the stage so he could see the Rolling Stones. During the Stones' performance, the Gimme Shelter documentary footage shows Meredith making several attempts to rush the stage alongside several other audience members. Meredith was high on drugs, which would later be confirmed during his autopsy. While the Stones were performing their song Under My Thumb, Meredith climbed on top of a speaker next to the stage to get a better view. This was spotted by the Hells Angels, who didn't like this, and promptly pulled him off, punching him in the face in the process. Meredith tried to run from the Hells Angels, but they assaulted him further. In an attempt to protect himself, Meredith withdrew the pistol, and it was at that point that Angel Alan Pizarro stabbed him twice fatally. Pizarro stabbed him 4 more times as he laid on the ground limp and bleeding. Pizarro and other angels surrounded him and began kicking and stamping him viciously. One of the angels then picked up a metal garbage can and dropped it on Meredith's head. Where the hell a garbage can came from in the middle of a rock concert crowd, I don't know, but it was there. The assault continued until Meredith had stopped moving, lifeless. Pizarro then told the surrounding witnesses, quote, "Don't touch him. He's going to die anyways." So, I've re-gone over a large piece of the background info from our last episode, but hopefully that provides some clarity on the root cause for what would come later. Alan Pizarro would later be arrested and charged with murder, but he was acquitted after the jury saw the footage from the event and deemed Pizarro's actions self-defense. After they stated, they saw Meredith draw a weapon. This was quite an interesting observation from the jury, in my opinion, given how there is no firearm visible in the footage. Take a look for yourselves. The footage of the event is available on YouTube. Let me know what you can make out from the film. It's worth adding that Pizarro would later drown in Anderson Lake in Morgan Hills, California, on March 29, 1985. The local sheriff department's detective unit would call his death kind of suspicious at the time, although no foul play was ever identified or confirmed. His body was found with more than $10,000 in cash on him. In the immediate aftermath of the concert, the blame for all of the violence and the concert descending into chaos was placed firmly on the Hells Angels. The Rolling Stones vowed to never work with the group again, and also made a series of particularly negative comments about the Angels in the media. This was perhaps a mistake. This angered the Angels, who felt insulted that Jagger and the Stones didn't make an effort to defend them in the press. A couple of weeks after the concert, the Oakland Hells Angels chapter president, Sonny Barger, who was present at the concert, called into a radio show where Jagger and Charlie Watts, the Rolling Stones drummer, were present. He defended the Hells Angels' actions at the concert. You can listen to that entire call and the following comments from Watts at the end of the last episode, where I included the radio show audio. The Hells Angels were enraged that the Stones didn't publicly defend them, so they decided to issue a contract on Mick Jagger. They were intent on killing him for his disrespect. And indeed, the Hells Angels made numerous attempts on the rock star's life. The first would occur in 1975, when an assassin tracked Jagger down to a hotel in New York City that Jagger was staying at. The biker hitman, who was carrying a silenced pistol, waited in the hotel lobby for Jagger. Fortunately for Jagger, the musician never showed up. The next attempt on his life would be the plan I spoke about earlier in the episode. A lot of organization had gone into it, and the Angels were determined this time. The Angels, a team of three, loaded a small boat with explosives and quietly rowed across the Long Island Sound headed for Jagger's house. They were focused on their plan, executing a huge explosion that would ultimately kill the rock star. It appears that Jagger was lucky once again that night. The plan would turn into complete disaster. The weather turned suddenly and a storm rolled in, capsizing the Angels' boat and losing the explosives beneath the waves in the process. The hitmen swam to the nearest shore, barely surviving. It wasn't until 1983 that this plot would be revealed to the public. A former Hell's Angel, known only by his alias Butch, testified under oath. He was appearing before a United States Senate Judiciary Committee that was investigating the links between motorcycle gangs and the mafia. Butch swore, as part of his testimony, that he had attended numerous meetings where plots to kill Mick Jagger were openly discussed. The Angels felt that the Rolling Stones had worked to turn public opinion against them in the aftermath of the Altamont concert, and they were set for revenge. Butch also told the committee that the contract against Jagger was still open as of 1983, and even though the first three attempts had ended in failure, he predicted that eventually they would be successful. Butch stated that whoever does it well will earn quite a trophy. In a 1979 attempt on Jagger's life, and another instance involving explosives and a boat, the Hells Angels would utilize a small pontoon boat packed with plastic explosives. They planned to row the pontoon boat out to Mick Jagger's private yacht, which was docked at Martha's Vineyard. One of the hit squad, George Christie of the Ventura, California chapter of the biker organization, later admitted in an interview that they came so close to achieving their mission. But they hit one snag. There always seems to be a snag. The boat started taking in water while they were situated halfway between the shore and the yacht. Not wanting to be rescued by the Coast Guard with plastic explosives on him, Christie stated that he abandoned the boat, his friends and the explosives, and jumped over the side and swam for the shore. Maybe attempts on water were not the best way to go for the Angels. In 1982, a Hells Angel who went by the moniker of Big Boy concocted a plan once again to use explosives to kill Jagger. Big Boy, however, decided to play the long game on this one. He obtained information of the car service that Jagger regularly used while he was in the United States. Jagger, at the time, had a home on the Upper West Side of New York City, so Big Boy began to stake out the building and observe Jagger coming and going. This whole scenario is sickeningly similar to the whole Mark Chapman and John Lennon incident. It was around the same time, too. Whilst Big Boy could have taken a similar path to Chapman and just shot Jagger as he was leaving or entering his apartment building, Big Boy knew he had a better chance of getting away with the murder if he used timed explosives and ensured he was nowhere near the explosion. Big Boy instead acquainted himself with one of the drivers at the car service that Jagger used, a driver who was regularly assigned to Jagger himself when he ordered a car. Not an easy task, but he pulled it off. The long game, essentially. After a number of months, Big Boy became particularly close to Earl Heyman, the driver in question. Big Boy considered offering Heyman a large chunk of change to complete the hit, but ultimately, he felt this would still lead back to him. Heyman wasn't a hitman. He was a legit guy. Too much could go wrong. So Big Boy came up with another plan. From stalking Jagger, he gradually began to piece together this schedule, but he also subtly began piecing together information that he was getting from Heyman. He told him that he was a huge Rolling Stones fan and that it was really cool that he got to drive and talk to Jagger. Jagger didn't say much, Heyman said. Through regular conversations, Big Boy obtained pieces of information from Earl Heyman, and he eventually acquired the knowledge that Heyman would be driving Jagger to the airport later that month. Jackpot. He knew when and where Jagger would be exactly. Big Boy packed a sports bag with enough explosives to punch a large hole in the earth and placed himself across the street from Mick Jagger's apartment building. Big Boy knew that Heyman liked to arrive for his appointments early, and that Jagger would also often be late, keeping him waiting for a while. It was Heyman being early that was the important and useful element here. He observed Heyman arriving and parking up. He was 15 minutes early. Perfect. This, however, is where the plan gets flimsy, I feel. Big Boy casually crossed the street and began strolling towards where Heyman was parked. Heyman spotted him and honked the horn, waving to Big Boy, who pretended that he was surprised to see his friend. Big Boy stopped to speak with Heyman, who asked what he was up to. Big Boy said that he was heading to an appointment with his lawyer. And you know what? It's great that he happened to bump into Heyman in passing, he said. Why is that? Heyman asked. So, Big Boy asked Heyman for a favor. He said that he needed to meet with his lawyer, and the two may also follow that by going for dinner to discuss a joint business venture. The annoying thing, Big Boy said, was that he had his bag with him. He didn't particularly want to take it to a restaurant or carry around with him all day. He asked Heyman if he could possibly store his bag in the trunk of Heyman's car, and then he would collect it from him the following day. Heyman agreed. Obviously, the plan would have been to detonate the explosives that were inside the bag once Jagger had got into the car. Heyman popped a trunk, and Big Boy put the bag in, then left. Big Boy thought he was home free and had pulled it off, but the explosives never detonated. I swear that the angels are either incompetent, or at the very least, they endure the worst luck. This is where things went south for Big Boy. Heyman called him later that evening, and Big Boy seemed surprised to hear from him. He told Big Boy that he still had his bag if he wanted to come and collect it. Big Boy got suspicious and asked Heyman if he had opened the bag. Heyman said yes, then hung up the phone. It's not known why the explosives didn't detonate, but what Big Boy did know was that he wasn't going to go collect his bag. Earl Heyman was found hanged around a month later in what the police classified as a suicide. But some people, well, they suggest otherwise. The Hell's Angels decided to ease up in their attempts to kill Mick Jagger shortly after the 1983 Senate committee hearing. The comments had caused quite a stir in the media, and Jagger subsequently became aware that the Hell's Angels were trying to kill him. Keith Richards started carrying a gun with him everywhere he went. During media interviews with members of the Hells Angels after this, Sonny Barger stated that the Hells Angels had incurred around $50,000 in legal fees associated with the Alan Pizarro murder case. Barger also stated that Pizarro would never have been on trial, and the Hells Angels would not have 50 grand of debt if it wasn't for the Rolling Fucking Stones. Shortly after Barger gave the interview and claimed the Stones had caused the Angels significant debt, Barger stated that the Hells Angels suddenly received an unsolicited $50,000 payment. After this, Barger said, the hit on Jagger was called off. For the record, Mick Jagger has denied ever making any such payment to the Hells Angels. But what do you think? Who is likely telling the truth here? Reach out, DM me, email me, leave a comment. Let's talk, my friends.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.